and welcome to the Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. There is no more important asset to organized crime than a corrupt police officer. Those are the words of my guest today, a former police officer and undercover drugs operative himself. He now devotes his working life to campaigning against police corruption, for the protection of whistleblowers, and for reform of drug policy. Welcome to the Bunker, Neil Woods.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Neil, I did a bit of work in a number of interviews on the Daniel Morgan case and the report that followed it. And it was there really that the issue of police corruption came most sharply into focus for me. The report said that the Met is, not was, is institutionally corrupt. The Met in its response absolutely rejected this and said only some officers were vulnerable to corruption. Where is the truth between those two positions?
Well, absolutely, the Met is corrupt, but it's not just the Met. I don't just want to pick on London police officers. Corruption is a reality and it's unavoidable because of the structure of drug prohibition, the drug policy that we have. Even the methods of policing the drug markets inevitably increases and speeds up corruption within police ranks. So I wholeheartedly agree. And looking at the Morgan murder, the corruption was not unearthed. And I would suggest that that is because of institutional corruption in of itself.
So the Met is not unique in that respect. Do you think the focus is usually on the Met because of its size and prominence, or is there something structural specific to the Metropolitan Police that leads to more corruption?
Well, once you have systems of corruption which are linked to specific organised crime groups, then that can become embedded and multi-layered. And I would suggest that that's one of the reasons why the Met is so focused by this. Apart from the Morgan murder, there's been other studies into the Met. One, infamously, is Operation Tiberius, which was a study into a third of the areas, operational areas of the Met. And there were many, many corrupt officers identified as a result of that inquiry, making it quite clear that it was systematic.
Now, just for listeners to say, Tiberius is over 20 years old, yeah. Although it was only leaked about 10 years ago. And it looked at this issue quite holistically and made some recommendations. Some of them were accepted, but interestingly, you think they've backfired.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't adequately acted upon because I've seen the unredacted file of that, and there are named officers, and not all of those officers, well, they weren't all sacked, you know. Were named, but it's very oblique as to what was done about them. Now, a colleague of mine, who is also a member of Leap UK, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, he was in the Met, and he is a whistleblower for corruption in the Met. And he looked at Tiberius and each of those areas, those boroughs, and he says, well, yeah, that's right, but they've missed this one. They've missed this one and this one and this one. So it wasn't even complete, and it wasn't even the whole Met, that study. So it's clear that that investigation in its scope and the action following it was wholly inadequate.
And is that, do you think, because the impetus is to sort of punish the worst examples, to give some sacrificial victims, as it were, to this report or that report, but really protect the majority of people involved?
Yeah, well, the problem is, when talking about police corruption, and in particular the causes of it in terms of drug policy and our drug laws, is that, you know, if I'm speaking to an audience or I'm speaking publicly, it's so easy to be dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. Right, it's because people don't believe it. And partly the reason of that is because the first mandate of any chief constable in charge of a constabulary, including the Met, is to maintain public confidence. And if each constabulary was very public and honest about their fears, even their fears, let alone the reality of the extent of corruption, then that chief constable risks losing public confidence. So we have this catch-22 situation where we don't have total honesty as to the impact of our current drug prohibition on police corruption, but we're also stuck in this position where we can't expose it. Now, if the public understood the extent of corruption caused by drug policy, we would have a change in policy. So this becomes a political conundrum as well.
So your thesis is that there are significant links between drug policy and police corruption because of the way informants operate, just because of the vast amount of money sloshing around in that black economy. So can you just explain a little bit why reforming drug law would actually bring a change about in police corruption?
Yeah, okay. So because criminals control the drug market, it's over £10 billion pounds a year in the UK, the value. It's one of the biggest businesses in the world. It's bigger than textiles in terms of the value. So this is, we're talking huge, huge amounts of money, which is completely unregulated and controlled by criminals. So, yeah, the vastness of that wealth is obviously a significant factor. It is what gives organised crime its power to corrupt, right? Let's be clear about this. There isn't enough money in stealing cars. There isn't enough money in burgling houses for laptops to pay for this type of corruption. It also provides the infrastructure and organisational capacity to corrupt systems as well. But it's not just all that. It's also the mechanism of trying to police drugs. So let me just explain this. If the police catch a heroin dealer who controls the heroin supply in one half of a British city, right, there's a gap created by that activity in the marketplace. Now, one net effect of that is that violence increases because it's that gap, that opportunity is fought over by different actors. However, the actor who is most able to take up that opportunity is the dealer who controls the other half of the city. So it means that a gang or kingpin character, whatever it is, can expand their share of the market. And this has been happening at the higher levels of the drug trade all over the world for a long time. Now, if an organised crime group increases their share in the market, they increase their disposable income. And if they increase their disposable income, they always, and I mean always, invest that in corruption. Because corruption is the most important part of the business model. It's what keeps organised crime safe from prosecution. It keeps them free from prosecution by corrupting the court systems. It gives them an edge over their rivals. They can corrupt bigger systems. So the way this happens around the world and the impact of it is happening now, where we're having entire governments being taken over by transnational organised crime.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
On a daily basis at the moment, we're looking at the fall of Ecuador. That's drugs, organised crime, destroying the democracy of Ecuador to make for more efficient transit of cocaine.
Yeah, and before that, Haiti was in the news.
Honduras as well is another classic example. But it happens at each level. You know, it happens at national, regional levels. It happens in every way. And the nasty irony of this is that when you hear a politician or senior police officer or whoever say, we need to get tougher, we need more police, we need more arrests, we need more drug seizures, it plays into the hands of that dynamic completely. And in fact, many organised crime groups use the police informant system to get rid of rivals and increase their market share. So the police system, I mean, we should be looking at, okay, you know, we're taught to celebrate a big police seizure of drugs, right? We look at the big pile of dope on the table and we say, oh, well, aren't the police doing a great job? The system must work because look at that big pile of drugs. But that's the wrong measure. The size of drug seizures is not an evidence of success. A reduction in corruption would be, and a reduction in crime.
A couple of years ago, I spoke to Frank Vogel, who is part of Transparency International, and he was telling me that the unacknowledged part of the problem is that along with this illicit economy goes a legitimate economy that has built up all around it of accountants and lawyers and bankers and property developers. And actually a big chunk of our economy depends on that dirty money. So how do we address that?
Well, if the illicit economy was no longer illicit and governments took control of this vast trade, then that money could be reinvested, but with regulation instead of the lack of regulation that we have at the moment. Now, a lot of people who oppose my view in terms of the need to legally regulate these trades say that we just need to follow the money. We need to go after these enablers and these money launderers, and that's the way to solve the problem. But I call that the Al Capone fantasy, because the last time that we successfully followed the money and shut down a major gang with any impact was Al Capone in the chasing his tax at the end of the 1920s. So we're trying to chase the money. There are already people trying to chase the money, and we can't beat this because there's more money being invested in corruption than there can ever be investigated in investigative powers.
Neil, is your view supported by evidence from countries with more liberal drug laws? Can you see, as it were, the sanitizing effect of taking drugs out of that equation?
Absolutely, you can. Now, of course, I should emphasize that different drugs need different types of regulation. Some drugs are more dangerous than others, right?
So, of course,
some drugs are downers, some drugs are uppers. They need different kind of regulatory controls. And, you know, we would have to be very, very careful about how these drugs are regulated. Thankfully, there is an organization that already has the answers to those questions. They're called Transform Drug Policy Foundation. But I can give you an example of a country which has got it right in terms of opioid controls. Now, this is not because they're liberal. It's the opposite. It's a more strict government control, and that's Switzerland. So in 1994, Switzerland started prescribing heroin to their problematic heroin users, and they've had massive success. The Netherlands has copied them, and they also have massive success. So those two countries do not have an opioid crisis. In the UK, we're having thousands of deaths. We're going to have thousands more deaths when we have the synthetic opioids. But that risk does not apply in Switzerland and Netherlands because they have strict control, strict regulated control of the heroin supply to that population. And the real kick in the teeth from a UK point of view is that Switzerland used British evidence for that policy.
Can you explain that?
So up until the end of the 1960s, until America put us under pressure to adopt the more prohibition style, we used to treat addiction as a medical problem in the United Kingdom. So if somebody had a problem with heroin or cocaine, it was treated as an unfortunate medical condition, which it is, it's an illness. And they were prescribed heroin or cocaine to keep them safe, safe from the exploitation of organised crime, safe by giving them a safe supply that's not adulterated, and also to make sure that they're not living a chaotic life, trying to find the money to keep buying their next fix. So stability is the way to deal with addiction. Stability and care. And that's what they do in Switzerland. And in the UK, if we went back to the British system, we would have the additional benefit of dealing with county lines, children being exploited to sell heroin. Yep. Because when you've got doctors controlling heroin with a prescription pad, you don't have children controlling it, arming themselves with knives and hand grenades.
Neil, if I can widen the angle a tiny bit, speaking to a few friends on the force, there is a general sort of grumbling perception that the public want them to be saints, but that this is not a job for saints. That basically the policing by consent model requires a degree of all of us glossing over how the sausage is made. What do you think about that?
Well, I disagree. I think that policing has to hold itself to the highest possible standards, that there is no excuse for excessive force. There is no excuse for breaching the rules. And that, you know, I'm a strong believer in Peelian principles, the doctrine that which set out what policing should be. Peel's principle number 7 is that the public are the police and the police are the public. Police are just merely the people with the responsibility and wearing the uniform. But the problem we have is that drug policy has broken what policing is. It's breached that link between police and community. It's put the police at odds with huge proportions of the population. If you consider that, even by conservative estimates, there are 3 million regular adult cannabis consumers in the UK, they're suddenly at odds with the police. And they have the duty of care from the police as much as anybody else, right?
Yeah.
So drug policy is the problem. It's drug policy which has broken policing. And let's face it, if we had legal controls and legal regulation of these drug markets, the police would be able to concentrate their resources onto other things which actually have societal benefit.
Okay, but then the elephant in the room becomes recruitment, because police forces are really struggling to fill vacancies because pay is shit and expectations extremely high, and they're constantly being told to up the standards of who they let into the police, while also given inane targets of X tens of thousands new officers. I mean, how can you reconcile? You can't reconcile those things. Something's got to give in that equation. You will either let the wrong people in, or you will not meet the targets.
Yeah, well, I would agree that police need more support. They do need that pay rise and better conditions. But I think the elephant in the room, as you put it, in this case, is what people aren't talking about. And that's there's a mental health crisis in policing. There are now twice as many people off sick every day with stress with police than there was 10 years ago. And that is a dramatic, dramatic problem at the moment. I'm actually working on an event. If people follow me, they can get details about the event. If people follow me on Twitter or whatever, or LinkedIn. We're having an event with the University of Law, which will be looking at this. And part of the solution, interestingly, especially from a drug policy point of view, part of the solution is to speed up access to psychedelic therapy for police officers. Because it's coming, right? It's going to be licensed this year. MDMA therapy is going to be licensed this year in the United States. Psilocybin's already been licensed in Australia. We want police to be at the front of the queue for that. And we're going to be having an event to talk about how we actually do that. So the dark irony about that is that some of the drugs that people have been persecuted for may well actually save policing from this crisis.
And just to let listeners know that on Twitter you are WUDZEE0, Woodsy.
Yes, Woodsy0, that's me.
Right. Okay, the Daniel Morgan report exposed a network of links also between police and private investigators and news organizations. And I'm wondering, is that part of what normalizes corruption? What I'm trying to say is, if one accepts money to pass information to a tabloid, if you cross that line to doing dodgy stuff, are you then not on a slippery slide? So could a zero tolerance approach to how we treat infractions seen as more minor also be part of the answer?
I think there already is a zero tolerance approach, to be honest. I think most professional standards departments in most police forces actually work very hard, and they are absolutely brutal in their efficiency in investigating what they do. The trouble is, corruption's really difficult to investigate. It's really, really difficult. And part of that is because the power of organised crime is so vast. And there are multi-layers to this as well. You know, I speak to cops all over the world about how this works. And a system that organised crime uses, they have people who are embedded and they are sort of cocooned and safe.
The clean skins, you call them, right?
Well, a clean skin is somebody who has no previous convictions and they're employed to actually join the police. So they're embedded in. But the more sophisticated organised crime will keep those and not ask them to do anything which puts them at risk, so they stay there as an asset, right? They use those people to then look for opportunities to corrupt other cops. So look for opportunities like someone is vulnerable, someone has a drinking habit, someone's got some debts, whatever it might be, to entrap them. So there's multi-layers to this, and it makes it very, very difficult to unpick. Mm. But that's because drugs have made organised crime powerful.
Mm. And this is part of the reason why the Operation Tiberius recommendation to sort of limit the time someone can be a handler for an informant to 5 years actually had the opposite effect. You basically created a dating service, an introduction service, which meant that loads of police officers were introduced to loads of informants rather than kind of siloing the possible damage.
Yeah, up until 2001, it was quite common for source handlers to be in post or people handling informants for years on end, a decade or so, and that relationship was identified in the aftermath of Tiberius as being a significant risk in sort of embedding the link between organised crime and specific individuals. But as you put so well, the change in that, the rotational aspect of it, of moving around every someone between 3 and 5 years, just cast the net wider. It allows more people to come into contact. Now, I know that there'll be former colleagues of mine shouting at the wherever they're listening to this podcast that they disagree permanently with this, but I've heard too many things and spoken to too many people not to conclude that it has had that opposite effect and increased the risk.
A couple of questions to round the conversation off. I think as in the Postmasters scandal, I find it quite difficult to discuss this because we all operate on the assumption that those who wield authority, while not infallible, do not set out with wicked intent. And if I didn't operate on that assumption, then I would be permanently, I think, paranoid and terrified. Do you think there is a sort of psychological barrier to confronting the issue that emanates not just from the police, but also from the public? Are we hesitant to know the extent of the problem?
I mean, I first have to say that, you know, the vast majority of cops are honest and uncorruptible people. Mm. You know, there's a lot of cops out there working very, very hard. And they feel it really harshly. They feel it in their gut when they hear this kind of thing talked about. But it might be a minority, but the minority of corrupt cops can do an enormous, enormous damage. But you're right, the public don't want to believe it. They find it hard to believe, but that's because we've got such a long tradition of having very high confidence in policing in this country and across Northern Europe, in fact. Mm. It's very, very high, persistently high confidence levels, even at this time of what could be perceived to be a political crisis in policing in the UK and North America and elsewhere. It's still very hard. It's very hard for people to believe it. And perhaps that's because it's so unsettling. But I think precisely because it is difficult for the public to understand and face up to, we really need to be honest about this. Mm. We need some political leadership where we can talk about this and not shy away from where this leads us to the inevitable conversation that we've seriously got to redesign our drug policy so that we're not empowering the most dangerous peoples in our communities with this great wealth.
Okay, final question. I think there is a tension inherent in all such organizations with essentially a military command structure. They only really work if there is a sort of stonewalling solidarity in place. And whistleblowing and rooting out corruption kind of unpicks that fabric exactly. So can this be done without fatally weakening the force operationally?
Yeah, there is an element of those two things being at odds, yeah, definitely. Mm. And one aspect of that is the sort of canteen culture, if it's an unfortunate phrase, but the sort of camaraderie, you know, that cops need to trust who they're working with because they go into dangerous situations and they need to know that someone can get the cover of their back. So that's another thing that feeds into it. But unfortunately, that can also feed into a toxic culture where loyalty to one's companion is at odds with the ethics, is at odds with what needs to be done. And that is culturally a very difficult thing to unpick. So what we need to do is to really develop the mechanisms for whistleblowing, a culture which protects and even venerates, even celebrates whistleblowers. Now, that's a hard ask. And that's a big cultural shift. That's difficult. Yeah. But I think that's what we should be aiming for. However, as I always have to, I have to add this caveat that you can invest in your professional standards investigating team. You can invest in a whole new cultural shift of whistleblowing as much as you like. You still can't beat organised crime. While we have this current drug policy, you can't. It's not possible.
Unless you drain the money coming in from the other side, basically, you can't.
Yeah, and that takes a complete change. You've got to take control of those drug markets. You've got to medicalise the heroin market. You've got to look after those vulnerable people. Because, you know, 10% of the most problematic heroin consumers, the ones who are using the most drugs, the ones who are the most traumatised, who are desperately trying to self-medicate for childhood trauma, that 10%, they're using 50% of the market value of heroin. So if you only take care of that 10%, you're taking away half of that commodity's value of money away from organised crime. That is what hinders the ability of organised crime to corrupt. You've just got to see it in economic terms. There's no other way.
Neil Wood, thank you so much for your time today and for the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
These conversations that I know you enjoy because you're kind enough to tell me cost money to make, so please consider supporting us from as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. A few bad apples is the perennial response to allegations of poor behaviour by those in positions of authority, as if those people are not representative of an organisation and eliminating them would eradicate the problem. But the full aphorism is actually one bad apple spoils the whole barrel and means quite the reverse. Bad behaviour is infectious. Immorality taints pervasively. Scandal has a wide collateral radius. Playing whack-a-mole with the latest example of corruption is therefore a futile exercise. What is needed is proper, systematic and ongoing quality control. But for that to happen, people in positions of leadership first have to be brave enough to admit that it is needed. This is Alex Andreu in the Bunker saying over and out.
The Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.